It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced his resignation today. We'll look at his legacy and who President Obama may be considering to replace him.
First, as the midterm elections approach, we often hear about how crucial women and women's issues will be in the election.
According to the Pew Research Center, health care and reproductive rights are high on women's list of election priorities, with more than half of women voters saying reproductive rights will be very important in their decision this fall.
With us now is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com. She's in town for an event called V to Shining V, which uses humor to celebrate women and look at the state of reproductive rights going into the election. Joan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you grew up in Wisconsin, you went to school at the university here, and then you left to become the editor-at-large of Salon.com. This weekend you're coming back for an event called V to Shining V. Tell us about that. What is it?
Well, this is an event nationwide. We're trying to sponsor lots of fun, lots of parties to promote issues around women's reproductive rights and reproductive health. It's a project of a group called Lady Park Justice, and if you think that's a funny name, it's intended to be. We've really come together around the crackdown on women's health access in the last 4 years. There have been literally hundreds of laws passed restricting access to birth control, restricting access to abortion, even restricting access to subsidized care, preventive care before the Affordable Care Act passed. And, you know, some of us have been wondering for a while how we've made so much social progress in so many ways, and yet on these issues we seem to be moving backwards. So Lady Parks Justice is mainly a collaborative of comedians. I'm not one of them. But the great Liz Winstead, co-founder of The Daily Show, and Sarah Silverman are the real movers and shakers behind this, trying to get people to have fun while they're doing politics and not look at politics as, you know, something that's just drudgery.
Right. It's an interesting mix. There's a combination of comedy and a serious political agenda. Why did you decide that this was a good combination to have, those two?
I think we're trying to reach people who are not necessarily motivated by politics, you know, around issues of women's rights, the crucial constituencies who generally vote to advance women's rights are young people, people of color, and women themselves, particularly unmarried women. And these are constituencies that, unfortunately, they may turn out every 4 years in presidential elections. Even then, not as much as as much as we would hope they do, but they really drop off in the midterms. And it seems to be, you know, looking at the last decade or so, that candidates who advance women's rights do pretty well in presidential years, and then there's backsliding in the midterm. So it was kind of an effort, just the way, you know, I like to think of Liz helping create The Daily Show and bring humor and irony and satire to really serious topics. And now you have young people saying, for better or worse, saying they get their news from The Daily Show because they really appreciate the humor and the heart. I think, you know, the same thoughts are behind Lady Parks Justice, that we have to reach people who don't necessarily think of themselves as political, and, you know, humor and culture are ways to do that.
Now, we hear time and time again that women are important in elections, but yet they don't seem to vote as a cohesive block around women's issues. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, obviously women are very diverse, and there are, you know, if you really dig down and get wonky about the numbers, which I like to do sometimes because I'm not a comedian, you know, there are big differences in the voting behavior of single women versus married women. Single women tend to vote more for both women's issues as well as on economic issues that are important to women. Married women, whether because they, you know, feel the security of being in a marriage, there are lots of theories about it, tend to be somewhat more conservative. There are big differences between, you know, sad to say it as a white woman, between white women and particularly black women who tend to be more attuned to the women's rights agenda as well. And so, you know, it's not that we want all women to think the same way, but we are trying to reach women who have concerns about these issues but may not be as likely to vote as, you know, I mean, I grew up in a nice upper-middle-class suburb, Shorewood, and it was just expected that you went and you registered to vote and you turned out to vote. It was just as routine as going to school and going to college, and all those things are related, right? In poorer communities, it's more of a day-to-day struggle to just get your life, you know, taken care of. And it's also, I think, poorer communities, single people, young people, haven't necessarily seen the usefulness of voting, and so there's less of a habit. It's just not as ingrained as with, you know, older white, upper-middle-class, and wealthy people. It's just what you do, and other communities not so much. So we're trying to reach out. We're trying to have some fun with it at the same time as we call attention to some really serious issues.
Now, we have this big midterm election coming up. What are the hopes and goals of Lady Parts Justice for the midterms?
Well, you know, we don't promote candidates. We promote issues. So the hopes and goals would be to, you know, turn out more women, to turn out more young people, and to get people to focus on women's rights. I mean, Wisconsin's a great example. There are now 96% of Wisconsin counties don't have any kind of abortion services provider in those counties. And it's not just that they're tiny rural counties that, you know, where nobody lives, that really covers more than 80% of Wisconsin women. So, you know, to exercise a basic human right, medical right, legal right, women are having to travel long distances, and you know, that makes access dubious and costly and sometimes impossible for women. So that's just one example.
Is your organization partisan, or is it something that splits, you know, in both directions?
Well, it's for everybody if you're interested in advancing women's rights. I mean, you know, we don't endorse Republicans or Democrats. You know, I'm sure most people would look at the things that we care about and consider us liberal. But, you know, there was a time in this country when, let's say, for example, Planned Parenthood was a wealthy Republican lady's cause. You know, Barry Goldwater's wife was a leader. Barbara Bush was very active. George H.W. Bush, Richard Nixon called him Rubbers because he was such an advocate of of contraception funding in Congress. These used to be absolutely bipartisan issues. And, you know, a really conservative, I would say radical cadre of people devoted themselves to making these issues controversial and to driving apparently a lot of Republican office holders away from them. And, you know, I have friends who are, you know, Republicans active in Planned Parenthood trying to hold on to that legacy. And, you know, I certainly wish them good luck with that. It would be great to take these issues out of the political realm. But, you know, a small group of people put them there. And for a long time, you know, people weren't adequately fighting back. I think we've seen people using humor, using culture, learning how to talk about this again, and maybe, you know, in a few years, these will not be controversial issues anymore. We can dream anyway.
In the past couple of years, we've seen language from activists saying that the country isn't engaged in a war on women. Do you agree with that? I haven't heard that language quite as much anymore, but is that still something that you think is true?
I think whether or not you know, like the rhetoric of war, I think it's pretty incontrovertible that we are going backwards when it comes to many women's rights. It's not just contraception. You know, there was just a vote to the Paycheck Fairness Act just failed in the Senate. It had a majority, but it couldn't bust the filibuster. And you know, that, again, used to be not as controversial. I think there's really a lack of attention to issues of poverty, which, sadly, again, are women's issues. Two-thirds of adults in poverty are women. two-thirds of, or more than two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women, and we can't get an increase in the minimum wage. And so, you know, and there's just been a lot of, certainly in 2012, you know, with all the unfortunate commentary about legitimate rape, you know, there was a real attempt to cast women as liars in terms of that whole thing came up because, the congressman in question, Todd Akin, was arguing that there doesn't need to be exceptions in any abortion ban for cases of rape because, you know, women don't get pregnant if it's a legitimate rape, meaning women are lying about being raped in order to have access to abortion. And so, you know, there is a lot of rhetoric that treats women as, you know, lesser people. The whole battle over birth control came down to, you know, calling women sluts and prostitutes, and really trying to shame women when, you know, a lot of people, as we've discussed repeatedly over the years, women should have access to birth control for birth control reasons, but a lot of women use birth control for other medical reasons. And, you know, it's a condescending, bullying kind of attitude to say that, you know, the government should get between a woman and her doctor. And so there's a real, you know, I think women made a lot of strides, and there's certainly been a backlash. And, you know, I think we've seen that in the last few years.
Joan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Joan Walsh. She's editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. You can find more information about Saturday's Vita Shining V event at LadyPartsJustice.com.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced today that he's resigning from his post. He says he'll stay until his replacement has been confirmed, which could take a while, maybe through the end of the year.
Holder is the fourth longest-serving attorney general in the country's history and the first African-American to hold that position. He's been outspoken on racial issues, eliminating sentences for nonviolent drug crimes, and his refusal to defend the country's Defense of Marriage Act. His relationship with the GOP-controlled House has been tumultuous throughout his time in office.
Here with us now to discuss his legacy and what it will take to replace him is Carl Tobias. He's Williams Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why now? Do we know why Eric Holder's stepping down now?
We don't. I don't think he said very much at the press conference about his reasons, but 6 years is a long time. He served right from the beginning of the administration and has long been a public servant in many capacities, and he certainly has taken a lot of criticism, as you mentioned earlier. So there are a number of reasons why he might want to return to the private sector.
And how does this impact the Obama administration, especially when it comes to Justice Department priorities?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the Attorney General is the face of the Justice Department, but the day-to-day operations are undertaken by the Deputy Attorney General and the Associate Attorneys General. But Eric Holder really did use that bully pulpit in lots of ways, and so he will be missed on some of the issues you've already talked about. And one that I see he played a prominent role in was settling the big bank fraud and mortgage fraud cases, where he really drove a hard bargain to settle those possible criminal cases. And so you definitely would lose that. And you lose some continuity, of course, when you have new people. But you expect that as an administration draws to its close.
Well, following up on that bank issue, a lot of the things we'll talk about, I think, involve criticism from Republicans from the right. I've seen some comments already since this morning saying, hey, he didn't do enough. The settlements, sure, but he should have been prosecuting leaders of banks related to the 2008 collapse and ensuing recession. Is that going to be a verdict a lot of people agree on, that he wasn't aggressive enough?
Perhaps. I think many believe that more individuals at the top should have been prosecuted personally, and I don't think we have seen much of that. But still, he did secure like $17 billion settlement from J.P. Morgan and I think $13 billion from Bank of America.
Now, one issue that a lot of people are talking about and that the Attorney General himself has talked about over the years is issues related to race when it comes to crime and punishment. Has Eric Holder been out front speaking explicitly about race where the president hasn't always been willing to venture?
I think that's clear. I mean, that may be his foremost legacy. It's a critically important issue, and he has raised that issue on many occasions in many fora and in many programs at the Justice Department. And while it's a difficult issue to discuss, I think he's been very candid and frank and clear that we need to address that issue and people need to talk about it. And Ferguson is a great, very recent example of the work he's done.
Do you think in the aftermath of Ferguson, he's really moved the needle on the conversation about police and race in this country?
That's a hard question to answer. Probably to some extent, but I think it's what he's done over the longer term, throughout his career, but especially during the Obama administration as Attorney General.
And bookended, we've got Ferguson at the end, and he got some controversy early on back in 2009 when he called the U.S. a nation of cowards when it comes to talking about racial tensions. Is that something that got him off on the wrong foot with some, maybe some in Congress?
It could be. It's probably true, though, so maybe he shouldn't have said it, but I think he's probably right, and I think he's done what he can to rectify or ameliorate that situation and try to keep discussion and lines of communication open.
Now, I mentioned a conflict with the Republican-led House since the Republicans took it over back in 2010. The fast and furious gun trafficking law enforcement effort was a big one, and in fact, I've just moments ago saw that the contempt issue will still be alive even after he announced his resignation. Was that fast and furious issue really a stain on his performance as an attorney general, or is that something that the Republicans in the House have made more of than was really there?
Well, I guess I think the latter view, but I think people can differ about that, how much responsibility he really had for that. And the contempt citation, I think, really comes out of his effort to protect the prerogatives of the executive branch in that particular fight. And we've seen that from both Democrats and Republicans, depending on who's occupying the White House. So I think on balance, I think stain is too strong, but it certainly wasn't the high point of the his tenure.
And is it uncommon to see that contentious a relationship between an attorney general and a party in Congress?
Unfortunately, I have to say it's becoming increasingly common and part of the partisanship that so many people associate with what's happening in the Congress and especially in the Senate, not only in the House, but now that apparently is part of the Senate culture as well, which is unfortunate.
Now, we've got, we'll need a new attorney general. The president will be having to deal with either a non-filibuster-proof majority in the Senate this year or a possible Republican majority in the Senate next year. Is this going to be, do you think, a trophy that Republicans in the Senate are looking for to possibly derail the next attorney general nominee?
Well, I hope not. And I think it may depend on what happens in the midterm elections and whether who has a majority in the 114th Congress, how this goes. Or it could depend on the type of person the president nominates. He may try to find someone who's a consensus builder who would not give the Republicans heartburn or cause them any controversy, and then it might go smoothly. But I think we'll just have to see. I think the Republicans are sensitive to the fact that that person needs to be there as soon as is reasonable. But the president can't even nominate anyone until the Senate returns on November 12th. So we'll just have to see.
We're talking to Carl Tobias. He's Williams Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, talking about U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's resignation announced earlier today.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What do you think Holder's legacy is? What do you make of the job he's done? Are there things that you thought were highlights or maybe lowlights? What would you like to see in the next U.S. Attorney General? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Times Facebook page. We're back with Carl Tobias Williams, a Williams Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, talking about U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's resignation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the news that Holder is leaving? What do you think, looking back on the job he's done? What would you like to see in the next U.S. Attorney General? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Carl, another big issue, obviously, for the Justice Department over the last 6 years, the war on terrorism. There has been criticism over violations of privacy, concerns over cyber snooping on U.S. citizens, people abroad. How do you assess Eric Holder and his Justice Department when it comes to those issues?
Well, there are a lot of different issues involved, and the obvious tension is between security and liberty or privacy. And I think it does seem that there may have been some overreach with NSA and other situations, and people have certainly criticized the Justice Department, and I believe Holder did authorize some of those activities. On the other hand, I think he pressed fairly hard for trying terrorists in civilian courts rather than in military courts and lost that battle to some extent, though the Justice Department has had considerable success in prosecuting terrorists in civilian courts. So I think it's a mixed record on that front.
And these are issues that the Bush administration was criticized for. The Obama administration, while speaking a different language in some cases, carried on similar policies. Are we going to resolve these issues, that balance you mentioned between rights to privacy and security in the next attorney general, in the next administration, whoever that might be?
Well, hopefully. But I suppose that the place where that really should happen is with our elected representatives in the House and the Senate, hopefully, and that they can work that proper balance. But it's a very difficult issue, I think, and one that's not easily solved.
Do you think that the Congress has done enough to pursue that conversation and to try to set the framework for the executive branch to work under?
Well, that's a good question. There may not be enough guidance. There may not be enough consensus in Congress to really give the executive much guidance. And the executive, no matter what the administration is, knows that national security is critical and that everyone looks to the president for that leadership. And so it's difficult, I think. But I would hope that Congress would play a larger role perhaps in the future, and there are some signs that it might.
So one of the biggest issues that's been in the courts the last handful of years has been over same-sex marriage, and one of the Attorney General's biggest actions is something decided not to do, and that was defending the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Was that an important decision? Did it change the way this issue has progressed through the courts?
Well, certainly the case that the Supreme Court had, which he refused to defend, it turned out to be really the impetus for the wave of litigation that we've seen since. And the Windsor case really has driven the cases like the Wisconsin case and others all around the country. Almost every federal district court and most of, and all the appeals courts so far have basically ruled in favor of marriage equality. And so by deferring there, he may have opened that door to some extent. And certainly he has strongly supported marriage equality.
Yet another issue, and this was one right from the start, voting and civil rights. We talked about some issues of race relations earlier, but early on there were rumors that the Civil Rights Enforcement Branch of the Justice Department was, some described it, in shambles, and he made a priority of fixing that up. And then there was a Supreme Court case on voting rights, especially in southern states, stemming from the 1960s. Can you talk about Eric Holder's role in those issues?
Well, I think he was a very strong advocate of civil rights and tried to push as hard as possible in that area. And you're correct, the Supreme Court recently said that there would not have to be preclearance of voting changes, and that has set up a very different dynamic. He's tried to respond to that in other ways and tried to be creative, but that does change quite a bit and puts the onus on plaintiffs who want to challenge those changes. And so that's really worked a fundamental change, but he certainly fought that and lost at the Supreme Court 5-4.
Now, stepping away from particular issues, how significant is Eric Holder's legacy as the first African-American Attorney General of the United States?
Well, I think it's very important, but I think what's been most important is the way he has spoken out and led and tried to generate conversations and initiatives involving race and especially the criminal justice system. And I think that is a very valuable legacy to have.
Moving forward, what do you think are pieces of unfinished business that Eric Holder leaves behind as he leaves the office whenever his successor takes office, which is still an open question?
Well, obviously the issues I just spoke about are unfinished. They are with us all the time, and I think he has helped to move that conversation along, but that will always be important into the future. A number of the investigations, for example, he was instrumental in the Toyota settlement of the large criminal case. There is a similar investigation of GM ongoing now, and that will have to be wrapped up. But the Southern District of New York, I think, has all of that under control. So I think those are some of the issues that remain. And I think the criminal justice issues will have to continue to be worked on. For example, which cases ought to be prosecuted and what kind of sentences should be handed down and that type of thing.
We'll leave it there for now. Carl, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Carl Tobias. He's the Williams Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, talking about U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's resignation, which he announced earlier today. Time for our Share Something segment. Each week, we ask one of our guest experts to share something for our listeners. This week, we've enlisted one of our science regulars to give us a rundown of some citizen science projects we can get involved in.
Gemma Tarlak is here. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Always great to be with you. Thanks.
Well, before we start getting into specific projects, what is citizen science?
Citizen science, basically, it's a win-win situation. You know, scientists, their funding is getting cut. It's difficult to get the research done just financially. But also, there is just so much data out there, and there's more all the time, that, you know, a group of 5 or 6 or even 10 scientists working on a project, they just don't have the hours in the day to process all the data. And some of it has to be processed by humans. The computers can't. So they ask people, hey, can you help us out? Can you be part of the science? So for the scientists, it's a win. For the people helping out, the citizens, It's also a win because you get to experience what it's like to do research. And I think there's a tremendous feeling of ownership when you see the results and, you know, you hear maybe on the nightly news them talking about new findings about the monarch butterfly population or whatever, something you participated in. And you get this tremendous sense of ownership and understanding how awesome science is.
Now, we've been hearing about citizen science for a long time, but is it working? Are people starting to get involved in greater numbers?
Yeah, you know, in fact, I think last year was really the first year that we saw several studies coming out that were based on crowdsourced data processing or citizen science that actually had real results. Everything from citizen scientists looking at cancer cell slides of patients and being able to diagnose, obviously, you know, they're going to run it past a physician, but being able to identify specific cancerous cell structures that were not found, say, by the computer. So we're seeing more and more studies coming out with real results, and I think it's getting more popular, especially, you know, among the younger, the children and young adults, because there's also an aspect that's part of, like, the maker revolution, really DIY, getting your hands dirty, really getting into the process of things.
So this month you had a piece highlighting a selection of citizen science projects. How did you decide what to include?
Well, you know, there are so many. There are thousands of citizen science projects. So we narrowed our focus in a couple different ways. First, in terms of time, we knew the story would be running in our October issue, and we wanted to spotlight things that were either about to be available or had just become available so that someone could read about it and jump right to that project and join it. So timing was one issue. And we also wanted to give our readers a sense of the tremendous variation, not only in fields of science, but in ways to participate. So everything from looking at a computer screen and marking changes in the image on your screen to walking your dog at night with your smartphone, seeing something flash in the sky, and using your smartphone to track it. So there are all different ways to participate and all different fields you can participate in.
Well, one that you are especially excited about, I guess, is this baby watching project. Who doesn't like to watch your cute babies on the internet?
Well, you know, it's an interesting project, Baby World, and it's by the folks who brought us Games with Words and a couple other vocabulary-based and linguistic citizen science projects and also online quizzes. And I know I have several friends who are absolutely addicted to Games with Words. And this is really looking at how children or babies understand speech and pick it up. And, you know, we think a lot of times just looking at the baby and saying, oh, you know, baby, coo, 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 who's a good baby or whatever, that is how they understand language. But when you think about it, your baby is in the room and you're talking to your spouse or your friend, whoever, saying things like, hey, how was work today? That's a very abstract question. How does the baby understand that? So basically people look at these videos of children in their environment and note what interests the child most. If it interests the child most, it is most likely to get embedded in the child's brain in some way, including adapting to language.
So this is a case where there's a lot of data, probably hours and hours, hundreds of hours, I don't know, of these videos, and that's why the scientists are like, hey, public, help us out.
Yeah, you know, I would say more than half of the projects we picked, it is a question of just the sheer amount of data that the actual researchers just don't have the time to process it. And Baby World is definitely one of those issues. But, you know, you as the citizen scientist do not have to watch hours and hours of babies. They're actually 15 to 30 second clips, just very short video clips. And you basically just look at it. You know, 15 to 30 seconds, shorter than your average YouTube clip of some guy skateboarding and hurting himself. And, you know, you just say, okay, the baby was very interested in the mother, or the baby was very interested in the shirt the man was wearing. Whatever it is, you mark it down, and all that gets processed, and that's how they are doing the study. It's pretty fascinating.
And I guess all of these experiments, they presume good faith by the participants that people aren't going to try to mess up your baby data.
Well, yeah, and actually all citizen science experiments, there's actually protocols, and I believe it's a researcher at Cornell University who created kind of a best practices guide for researchers undertaking citizen science projects. And one of the things they do is usually it's not just one reviewer looking at a video. Usually they'll have three, four, five people who don't know You know, it's not like, you know, two people in a room are looking at the same video. It's a person in Albuquerque and a person in Poughkeepsie. They both, you know, randomly are selected to look at that video. And maybe another one in, I don't know, Salt Lake City. And they look at the video, so if there's an outlier, you know, if there's that joker who just wants to screw up the data, they will stand out.
Interesting.
And they can be eliminated from the study results.
Well, let's check out some of the other projects we can get involved in. There's one called eMammal. What is that?
Well, this is all about setting up a camera trap, either in your backyard or, with permission, in a local park. And the folks studying this are looking at how animal wildlife populations, everything from coyotes to bears, et cetera, how they are moving between urban, suburban, rural, and wild environments. And they're just trying to get really an idea of how these animals are moving between these very different environments, also their numbers, how they might be interacting differently with, say, prey or predators in those environments, and just giving folks a much better idea. It's like a wildlife survey or census that also takes into account behavior changes as well.
And there's also a meteor reporting app. How does that one work?
Well, this is the one that you just, you know, you've got your smartphone, you've got the app on your smartphone, you see a bright flash in the sky, basically a fireball, it's a particular type of meteor, and you engage the app, wave your smartphone kind of basically from where you saw it start to finish at the speed you saw it. You do it a few times, which is measuring and the accuracy and creating consistency, and the actual app processes the data and sends it to the American Meteor Society, which then adds it to kind of a, again, a census, basically, of fireballs that are, you know, winging around over us.
Well, that's staying on top of astronomy in real time. There's another project that looks super cool and maybe shows our superiority to the infernal computers, one tracking artifacts at the Museum of London. How can we help the Museum of London out?
Yeah, well, actually, this is, it's a British museum, and they have thousands and thousands of artifacts from the Bronze Age, specifically axe heads. And you might think it sounds like the easiest job in the world for a computer to look at a photo of an axe head on a plain background and kind of outline that axe head so that it can be digitally modeled. This, believe it or not, is actually too much for the poor computer to handle.
Aha.
Poor computer. They have found the process of kind of marking that outline and separating the object from the background is called photomasking. And they have found humans do it way better than computers. So they've got all these thousands of axe heads from the Bronze Age, and they are looking for citizen scientists to just help them digitally mark out the outline. They're then going to create digital models of all these artifacts that can be shared and studied, and, you know, the actual artifacts will be able to be safely protected and not have to travel around to different research institutions.
Interesting. So we do some tracing, and then they can do 3D models that anybody in the world could study.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's another one that involves transcribing some old text, right?
Yeah, that's another aspect of the story. You know, they have all these pages and pages and pages of notes from, you know, the early 20th century, I think even from the 19th century. And you could have that one sad graduate student sitting in a basement transcribing it all. Or you could say, hey, citizen scientists, do you want to be part of it? And a lot of people are really interested in reading, you know, the very old field notes. Some of them have incredible sketches of the artifacts as they were found, and basically just transcribing it so that, again, they can be digitally reproduced and available to anyone in the world.
Now, here's one that doesn't involve sitting in front of the computer, Nerds for Nature. I think it's on the West Coast, but there might be other things going on like it around the world. What is Nerds for Nature?
Yeah, and I love this organization because it is all about getting out and, you know, getting up to your knees in mud. It started in the San Francisco Bay Area, but it is expanding, and they also have some online tools. So if you're interested in being part of it, you can stage your own BioBlitz, it's called, in your area. What's a BioBlitz?
Sounds dangerous.
No. Trust me, no organisms are harmed in a BioBlitz. Basically, you grid off an area in your neighborhood, in your local park, wherever, and you and your friends just take a census of every living creature in there. It helps to build wildlife census population data. It helps to understand even the health of certain areas or how certain areas are changing from one ecology to the next. And it's, again, gathering data, helping scientists do things that they just don't have the time or resources to do.
Now, there's a final one that you write about Hurricane Sandy. It's a cool opportunity for people to check out photos before and after the hurricane and decide what changes they see.
Yeah, and I have to admit, of all the projects, this is the one closest to my heart for a couple of reasons. This is, again, a project that we do it better than the computers. If you show the computer a photo of the Jersey Shore before and after Hurricane Sandy and ask the computer, hey, what's changed? The computer freaks out, gets out of off your desk, runs into a corner and starts weeping because there is just too much going on in the photo. There's a difference between water and land. There's a difference between, say, hillside, grassland, meadow, beach, stone beach, sand beach. There are all these variations happening in the same time. The computer can't handle it. However, a human can look at it and say, okay, I see that road shifted there, the sand beach shifted there, this is gone, this is here. So basically, humans are looking at all these before and after photos, and there's a short online tutorial about how to do it, you know, what terms to use, for example. You put in the data, that data gets processed, and it's helping the U.S. Geological Survey understand things like, okay, how far inland did the water really travel? How much of the beach was destroyed? It's helping them identify even, say, floodplains or flood areas at risk of storm surge, and they're going to be using this information to figure out, as other storms come up the coast, hey, how can we help people? Who needs to be evacuated? Who is at risk? What can we do to mitigate the damage? So it's a real kind of real-world thing. And for me personally, I grew up in the New York area, so a lot of the photos, I'm like, hey, I was there.
Well, Gemma, a lot of great stuff we could participate in. Thanks for joining us again.
Always fun. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She was with us to share some citizen science projects.
And you can see all of Discover Magazine's citizen science project suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page. And by the way, head over there. Are you doing something like this, either one of the projects Gemma just told us about or something else? I know there were big protein folding crowdsource things a few years back. Backyard astronomy that you're sharing your data. Let us know if you are involved in citizen science at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.